Welcome to the Mentor Files. I'm your host, Monica Royer, founder and CEO of Monica and Andy. Join me as I chat with some of the world's leading entrepreneurs, inspiring CEOs, and experts at the top of their field to bring you the audible MBA, unfiltered advice, and mentorship every mover and maker needs to find their voice and success. Here we go. Our guest today is the founder and CEO of Beauty Counter, Greg Renfrew. Greg has a track record of being a visionary entrepreneur, exiting her first venture in 2001 with the sale of her company, The Wedding List, to none other than Martha Stewart Living. Greg moved on to launch Beauty Counter in 2013, pioneering the clean beauty movement. Decades of studies indicate that certain toxic ingredients commonly found in skincare and beauty products can lead to serious health issues. With this in mind, Greg saw an opportunity to build not just another beauty brand, but to provide safe, high-performance products to consumers with the mission of transforming the $70 billion beauty industry in the U.S. In just 7 years, Beauty Counter has become the leader in clean skincare and makeup category. They've revolutionized the beauty industry through their digital presence, retail partnerships, and independent consultants, and the world has taken notice. Beauty Counter was recently named number one on Fast Company's 2020 list of the world's most innovative beauty companies. In today's episode, Greg walks us through her personal journey to becoming a founder and how she pioneered the clean movement. She details how she's handling her business in the current COVID climate and preparing how to best serve the community in the future. Her focus on building a successful company while also positively impacting the world is truly inspirational. Incredibly excited today to welcome Greg Renfrew, the founder and CEO of Beauty Counter. Greg, welcome.
Thank you.
And I feel like I think almost everybody listening to this is going to know Beauty Counter, but for somebody that maybe doesn't, tell us a little bit about it.
So Beauty Counter is both a brand and a movement. We're a company with a mission of getting safer beauty products into the hands of everyone. And we launched about 7 years ago with the desire to really shake up the beauty industry to prove that you could create really high performing products that were significantly safer for health and empower people through understanding what's really going on out there and the products that they're putting on their bodies every day.
And when was Beauty Counter founded? It was like 2011, Greg?
So I started concepting Beauty Counter in late 2010 and we launched in March of 13. So we're 7 years in the actual marketplace, but about almost 10 years in the making.
And tell us a little bit about when you first started to think of the idea for Beauty Counter. So how did, when you first started to think about it, how did the idea first come to you?
You know, it really came to me over a period of several years. Back in 2006, I watched An Inconvenient Truth, the film An Inconvenient Truth, and became very impassioned with the environmental health movement, started to realize we were doing things that were truly detrimental to the earth. And subsequent to that, I was watching so many of my friends struggle with different types of issues, whether it was the friends who were struggling with fertility issues, being diagnosed with different types of cancer, or giving birth to kids with significant health issues. And I started to draw a parallel between the things that were detrimental to the earth and those that were detrimental to human health. And the one thing that I could point to was our exposure to toxic chemicals. And so for a couple of years, I started to make significant changes in my life, changing out household cleaning products, switching from plastic to glass in my home, taking my shoes off of the door. But when it came to skincare and personal care products, I just couldn't find any products that met what I would say my new high standards that I, you know, I really wanted products that performed extremely well, but that were also void of all these chemicals of concern. And so I started Beauty Counter really to create a company, but also a movement to disrupt and innovate within an industry and to bring safer products into homes across, you know, North America.
And from the time that you started thinking about it, Greg, how long was it until you really were able to get it rolling? Was that 2 years or a year? Or like, what was the length of time between when you started thinking about it to launch?
It took us approximately 2 full years to really decide how we wanted to distribute the products and then to formulate the products. I sort of thought at the beginning that I could just take a base formula from another brand through a contract manufacturer and tweak a few things, but that wasn't really the case. We had to do an inordinate amount of research and we had to start every single thing from scratch. I mean, you have to remember when I started Beauty Counter, there was no phrase clean beauty. It was still being called green beauty. And so we had to pioneer the clean beauty movement, create the formulation, start everything from scratch. And it took a couple of years.
Wow. And then for initial launch, Greg, did you raise money? Did you bootstrap, or like, how did you really get it off the ground from a funding standpoint?
I started by doing what, you know, the so-called friends and family round right in early 2011. I raised a couple hundred thousand dollars from a few people that I knew. I think I started with $200,000. And then over the course of between that time and March of 13, when we launched, I think we raised a couple of million more. Well, certainly we raised a few million more from individuals, the people who represented institutions, so that they could make larger size investments as individuals, but I didn't have the constraints of working with a venture capital firm. I really wanted to do this with people who were going to allow me the opportunity to build the brand in the way that I wanted. And it wasn't until much later that we brought in private equity.
I love that. And do you have advice, like, for people that are listening that are thinking about raising capital? It sounds like you've gone about it in like a unique way that's worked really well for you. For somebody that's just thinking about raising capital, what advice might you have for that person?
I think a couple of things. First of all, I always think that people forget that you are interviewing the person who has the capital as much as they're looking at your business plan, and that there's more capital in the market than there are great ideas. And so oftentimes I think entrepreneurs feel desperate, they feel worried, and they're willing to take anything. But I think it really makes a huge difference who your investors are. Are they aligned with your beliefs? Do they believe in your strategy? Do they believe in you? Are they going to be patient in down markets and moments like we're experiencing today? Or are they going to be, you know, ruthless in the way in which they approach business? I think it's critically, critically important that you really interview them, you check references from people that they've invested with before, and that you look carefully at the legal documents until you understand what happens, not just in the best of times, because it always seems very rosy at the beginning, but also what happens in difficult moments in time. And I think I had a bad experience. I had my own company, The Wedding List, many years ago, which I ended up selling to Martha Stewart, but I was forced to sell the company prematurely because of my San Francisco-based venture capital investors. And it really taught me that if you're not completely open and honest about what your intentions are with the business, which I was, but if you're not confident to say, no, this is how I'm going to run my company and this is what I want to do, if you're not confident in those conversations, you may, you know, decide to take in money with a company that isn't really aligned with your interests. And so when I went about it the second time around, I was unapologetic about what I was going to do. And they could either choose to put money behind me or they didn't have to, but I wasn't going to yield on what I believed in.
I think that's such a good point, Greg, and one that, you know, to really drive home to people that are listening, in the sense that I could not agree more. I think that what you said, vet your investors as much as they vet you, is absolutely critical. And I think that, you know, there's a broader idea of what you're talking about, which is really this idea of like shared values with your investors. And it's interesting, like I've had seen my brother's investors at Bonobos. My husband founded a company called Interior Define. You know, I've had my investors at Monica Nandy, and only speaking for myself, I feel like I've been really fortunate to have true operators that have invested in the company, which I think is for me been one of the keys. So it's like, the people that have invested, they've sat in our seats before. They understand what it's like. And so I feel like, one, they have an empathy for what the job entails. So as you said, it's like things like COVID hit, you know, it's like they put themselves in our position and they say, hey, we know that this wouldn't be an easy job to be at the helm of a company, any company at this particular time. And so I think it is like that idea of shared values and the value of where you want to head with the company is like a critical point to that. And so I think that, you know, bad investors can absolutely take your company down. There's no question about that. And good investors, it's not just about the capital they're putting in, but it's like, what additional things are they going to bring to the table? And that can be as simple as positive energy over time. But for, you know, I've got an investor by the name of Bobby Yazdani out of Cota Capital. And, you know, he always tells me the job of an investor is to see around the corner. And he'll say, you know, I've seen a lot of corners. And so my job is to see around the corner for you. And sure enough, I mean, in multiple board calls, you know, he's thinking like a year ahead and for the challenges that we're going to face a year ahead. And he's been right on so many accounts. And I feel sometimes as like a founding CEO, like I wish I was thinking about a year or 3 years or 5 years from now. A lot of times I'm not thinking that far past next week, unfortunately. I mean, I wish that wasn't the case, but that's the honest truth sometimes. And so I think that, you know, as people think about, should they take in capital or not? Of course, if you can bootstrap a company, more power to you. But if you are taking in capital, I think it's like to be, like you said, really smart about the way you take in capital. I just think it's so key because it can really make or break you in the long run.
Yeah, and I think all capital is not created the same. And I think that people also, there's something to be said for bootstrapping. And I would go as far as you can without taking in, you know, too much money, because then you end up giving away a significant portion of your equity before you've been able to realize a stronger valuation. But I think when you're undercapitalized, your company can also fail. And so there's a balance between taking in money when you don't need it, when you have confidence, when you can negotiate. And then when people talk about money and it's money, cash is cash is cash. It's like, what is the money bringing, what comes with that money? You know, not just on the downside, but to your point on the upside, where can they help you? How will they help you? Are they going to charge you for that help? A lot of times people say, oh, we have all these operators and people in our system, and then all of a sudden they send you a bill. So I've always, you know, wanted to know, what are those principals going to actually do for me? Are they going to roll up their sleeves and help me? Are they going to open up, you know, are they going to make introductions that I don't, you know, to people that I don't know myself? Or do they have expertise in a specific business or area that is useful to me? And all those things are really important as people think about, they think about raising capital to build a business.
Absolutely. And Greg, tell us a little bit about your acquisition in the early days. So I know that you've got a couple of brick and mortar stores now. Did you launch with brick and mortar, like omnichannel to begin with, or were you more of like a purely digital offering in 2011 or 2013 when you kicked it off?
Yeah, Beauty Counter is a direct-to-consumer brand that is powered for and made for people. And really, what does that mean? I mean, I think at the end of the day, the world didn't need another beauty brand. They needed a movement for change within the beauty industry. And so for me, I was trying to figure out how to distribute products, knowing that the traditional department store distribution of both beauty, but also just, you know, fashion, et cetera, was really waning. And obviously, we've seen that over the last couple of years. And right now, during this pandemic, I mean, I think it's safe to say that a lot of the department stores are in really, really big trouble. And we're going to see some of them file for bankruptcy. And I also thought that, you know, I knew that the direct-to-consumer business model was emerging. I was trying to understand, though, how to sell skincare and color cosmetics to a consumer for whom the desire to touch and feel product and smell the scent profile or to match a color to their skin was really important. And I knew e-commerce and digital was going to be a big part of it, but to me, that wasn't enough. And a friend of mine said, have you considered direct sales, to which I immediately said, like, hell no. I like those companies that overpromise and underdeliver. But I went and I took a look at the business model. And I thought, well, this is interesting. How could we create a new type of direct-to-consumer brand that has, you know, a network of independent consultants, has our own wholly owned stores, does partnerships with other retailers, and has a big digital and e-commerce platform? And so from day one, we created our business on a multi-channel platform, trying to meet, you know, the needs of today's consumer by allowing he or she, primarily she, to reach our products when they want, where they want, and how they want. And so we've been really successful in incorporating independent consultants who are building businesses on our platform, and then also incorporating, you know, traditional retail partnerships and e-commerce into one business. And it's served us well over the past 7 years.
And Greg, how did you find those consultants in early days, or like the people that were, you know, going out and selling the product? How did you start that force?
You know, it's funny because I literally went out there. I started with about 12 cities, and they were cities that I'd either, now, I grew up in New York, but I had friends in Chicago and Boston and Washington and San Francisco, et cetera. And so I literally flew or drove around the country, depending on where I was. And I got up and I started speaking to people about why I was starting Beauty Counter, why I wanted to create a movement. And I'm telling them that I wanted them to get involved, explaining to people that there are chemicals of concern being put into all the products that we put on our bodies every day, that go into our bodies, that go into our children, onto our children's bodies. And so I just started speaking the truth about what I was seeing out there and then how I was going to build the business. And, you know, I basically said, this is a movement and I need you to join our movement. And you can join in one of several ways. You can join as an advocate, as a friend of the brand and part of our community by texting your local member of Congress and telling them that we need cosmetic reform. And I say that because we haven't updated a major federal law in our industry in 82 years. And the one that exists is totally antiquated and doesn't allow for the FDA to recall products. They don't screen chemicals for safety before they go into the products that we use every day. So you could be an advocate and you could be a client and support us, or you could become a consultant and build a business on our platform that allows you to build and gain financial independence, or, you know, make that pocket money to buy that handbag you want, or to put braces on your kids, or pay for a home, or private school, whatever it is. But while simultaneously you could do that and have significant social impact. And I liked the idea of creating a digital first independent consultant who was able to leverage social media, monetize her influence, and do good in the world. And that we now have 50,000 women and men across North America who represent our brand and who've built very successfully businesses on a digital platform, utilizing their social channels, Zoom, FaceTime, you know, telephone, Boxer, et cetera, and are also help us with both education and advocacy. So it's been really compelling having this multi-channeled approach and having independent consultants representing the brand.
Oh my gosh. And 50,000, I mean, that is significant. Like, that is a really impressive number of people that are like directly out there that are promoting the brand. Tell us, Greg, a little bit about the early days of your product assortment and where that's come. Because I feel like one of the things that I always associate with Beauty Counter is that you have such a comprehensive assortment of product. And so for people that are listening that are thinking about starting their own company, like, help us understand what 2011 looked like in terms of like your go-to-market strategy and what you had at that time.
You know, it's funny, because when we launched the brand, we had, I think, 11 products. It was either 9 or 11, and it was basically essential skincare. So we had, you know, like your basic routine cleanser and your gentle exfoliator and your day cream and your night cream. And I think we had a couple of body products, shampoo, body wash, et cetera. Now today we have really a pretty comprehensive collection. And my goal was to meet the needs of a woman and her family. So we have baby and kids. We have skincare regimens for, you know, everyone from, you know, really, you know, younger teenage skin through, you know, age-defying sort of, you know, I don't like the word anti-aging, because at the end of the day, like, you are whatever your age you are. We should help women embrace their age. But, you know, when you really see, when people are trying to reverse the signs of aging, we have that kind of skincare line. And then we have a pretty comprehensive collection of color cosmetics, as well as men's products and personal care products that are gender neutral. And my goal was, how do I really meet her needs? How could I give her a one-stop shop where she can outsource her trust to us, not have to read every single label, not have to navigate the aisles and try to figure out which products are safe and which are not. And I think that one-stop shop has been really compelling for many of our clients, and also for our consultants who've decided to sell, where they wanted to be able to have some flexibility in what they're selling to their clients and being able to offer a wide assortment. And so that's always been intentional, and it's served us really, really well.
And tell me a little bit, Greg, about your brick and mortar footprint. I know that at the moment, none of us are particularly enjoying our brick and mortar footprints, but in the pre-COVID world, tell us a little bit about how those assimilated into sort of this omni-channel business that you've built.
So we started trying pop-ups about 4 years ago. We did one in Nantucket and in the Hamptons. We now have a store in New York City and in Denver, and one opening later this year in Los Angeles. And we had pre-COVID-19 intended to do a pretty significant, you know, retail roadshow of pop-ups across this country, which is probably not going to happen this year given all that's going on. But I think that what it does is it helps validate the brand. I think it gives people a place to play and to really touch and feel products. It gave our independent consultants a place to showcase the brand, to meet their clients, for us to acquire new clients into the brand. And it's been really successful for us on a per square foot basis. The sales have been off the chart. And I think it's one place where you can really tell the whole story of your brand. You know, we're lucky because beauty products are small, and so it doesn't take a whole lot of space to do that. We have a really successful store in Denver that's only about 260 square feet, whereas, you know, some companies obviously with a large assortment of clothing or gear or home decorative accessories or whatever furniture need a really large footprint, and we don't. But I do think that, you know, as much as people go direct to consumer and want to shop digitally, people do still love to play in stores. And I think even post this pandemic, I think it'll change, but I think people will go back into stores. We're seeing that emerge again in Asia, where people are less inclined to go to big malls, but they are going into stores. The traffic may be down, but the conversion is up. And I think there's still going to be a place for retail. I just think I read an article today that said that they were going to, that 100,000 doors were going to close. I mean, that's scary. And so I do think that there will be a huge shift in retail over the next 12 to 24 months, but I don't think it will go away completely.
I agree. We've had, you know, 18 physical pop-ups over the lifetime of the brand. Currently, we have 4 locations. So like a smaller footprint going into this, you know, sort of pandemic crisis. But I definitely feel like physical retail has definitely played a tremendous role in our acquisition, given that we started that way. So we had started where we did that from the very beginning. And in some ways, I don't want to say it worked against us, but I feel like physical retail like took over the first 2 years of the brand, where we like sold everything that we had in person. And it took us a while to actually build a digital presence because the physical retail part of things was so powerful. So it's interesting, Greg, to see how you went about it and doing physical retail later. What was it like for you when you walked into that first physical space after, you know, having already done the brand for a number of years, and then you walk in and everything's all in one place? What did that feel like?
Yeah, I'm always proud of those moments in time where you see something that was once just an idea truly come to fruition, and to see people in there shopping and to see people enjoying our brand. I mean, I think it was emotional in the same way that when we had our first annual conference with our independent consultants and I walked out and I saw all these hundreds of women and realized that we'd had an impact on their lives, that we're helping them educate their communities on the need for safer ingredients and helping them put, you know, I think we've put over 26 million safer products into homes across North America over the last few years. And when you hear people talking about your brand, or you see someone for you, you know, like if they're wearing something or they're talking about it, or you're in your store, it just feels so good when you think back and you're like, wow, like, yeah, I mean, it's a nice moment for someone who's an entrepreneur to see their ideas come to fruition and see people enjoying the thing that you've created. I, at least for me, it's always exciting.
Definitely. It's so true. I feel like no matter, and I didn't get a chance to go out to every store. Like you said, we've had stuff that's been anywhere from 300 square feet to like 1200. Like none of our stores are particularly big. In our case, we have like a lot of events and community. So on the ones that have been closer to the 1200 square feet size, like at least more people have fit in at the same time. But I love the idea of small square footprints for things. I think that there's a lot that you can pack, especially our product is also pretty tiny, maybe not quite as small as yours, but you know, baby clothes aren't particularly big. So we've been really fortunate to be able to pack ourselves into some of those smaller square footprints. And they certainly can be equally good customer acquisition tools to places that are bigger. And I feel like every time I've walked into a location and seen it for the first time, it's just like there's something emotional about it, seeing the brand on the walls and like bringing it together in a physical space. I mean, having a website's incredible too, but there's just something about walking into it. For me, that's always been, you know, just kind of a unique feeling, and certainly missing that these days without, you know, the opportunity to even walk into the office, I guess. Tell us a little bit about the team, Greg, at BeautyCounter. Like, what is the size of your team like at this stage, and what does all that look like?
So we have about 250 corporate team associates, more or less. Could be 240, could be 260, could be 270, but somewhere in there. We all work, almost everyone works out of our offices in Santa Monica, California. We have a few people who are regional sales directors who are in, you know, scattered about the country, but everyone else is in Los Angeles. And I mean, that's grown, you know, exponentially over the years. And then we, as I said earlier, have 50,000 independent consultants who are also representing the brand. And then, of course, we have our stores. So there are probably 15 people or 20 people who also work in our stores.
And how's that been? How's the shift with COVID been with like your full team? Do you feel like that's been seamless? I mean, I feel like it's crazy. I haven't seen my team now in what it's been like at least a month, maybe a little bit more than a month at this point. And it sounds like it's going to be at least another month, given all the things that we're hearing at a minimum.
Yeah. I think that, you know, it's been interesting. I think it's been actually a really positive thing culturally for our company to move into, you know, this digital format, which sounds crazy, but I think that we've really, all of us have been leaning into one another, leaning on each other. I've been really trying to lean into our people, make sure they feel supported, opening up lines of communication, trying to talk about what did and did not work in our company before and how we would like it to look, you know, coming out of this quarantine. And I think it's been an opportunity for us to really, you know, step back a little bit and to rethink things and to strengthen our relationships. And I've actually, as much as this has been an incredibly scary, sad time for so many of us, you know, I have so many friends who've been impacted by this directly, so many friends who've fallen ill, so many people have, you know, friends and family members on the front line. So I don't want to discount in any way the severity of the situation and how scary it's been for people. I think from a business standpoint for us, you know, as a team, it's been a moment for us to really lean in and support one another. And I think that I felt really good about that. But of course, it's weird. It's weird, you know, doing everything digitally. But, you know, you get through it. People get on. And I've been really, really proud of our team and how well they've handled this, because it's not easy, you know?
No, and with all the different things, I mean, anywhere from like your leases for your physical retail locations, it's like overnight, you know, as you said, in addition to like the really serious things that people are handling, like health and sickness and all of those things. It's like, as companies, it was just the type of things that we never planned for. And overnight, I feel like the same, our team really came together, but the job became so different in the short term, at least for me, where suddenly we were sort of encountering planning and doing all sorts of stuff that we just, I mean, generally, like I said, I'm sometimes not plan more than a week and a half ahead in terms of what I'm doing. But I feel like it was really just, it was like in the course of 2 weeks, everything changed, where it seemed like an impossibility that we were really going to be sheltering in place. And what would that be like, to like, wow, now we've been at this for a month, and, you know, for the homeschooling and all of the other things that have gone along with it, it's certainly been a learning opportunity. And I think that, you know, we've learned that like we can really come together as a team from home, which is just, you know, it doesn't discount the opportunity to be together in person. I'm certainly missing out on some of that, but I've been surprised at what the team's been able to accomplish, even at such a distance and with so many parents homeschooling their kids at the same time too. So I guess we didn't quite know what we were capable of before this, but it's been exciting learnings. Let's put it that way. Tell me a little bit, Greg, about what you think in terms of like the future of Beauty Counter and, you know, the things like opportunities that you still see on the horizon or things that you haven't had an opportunity to tackle yet.
You know, I think in some ways this is a huge opportunity for us. I mean, I think we're sitting in a very fortunate position as a company in that we're financially secure, thank God, and have capital, you know, to work with. But most importantly, we have a business model and a proposition that's, I think, important in this moment in time. I think as a company that stood for not only innovation and in clean beauty, which is obviously trending and was trending very high before, and now more than ever, people are, you know, putting their health and safety first, and so therefore looking to brands that they know are focused on health and safety, that are focused on authenticity and transparency. I think that combined with a business model that allows people to build a business at a time when so many jobs are being furloughed or so many people are being laid off, we actually have, you know, a flexible opportunity that someone can do from the comfort and safety of their home as an independent consultant. And so, you know, for us, we feel like we have a resilient business model and a proposition that matters, and that matters now more than ever. And so we're enduring difficult times as every other company and brand is out there, but I think we're well positioned to weather the storm. And I think I am constantly right now trying to figure out where we're going to be as a country, post-pandemic. What are the things that are going to emerge? With every crisis comes opportunity. How can we better serve our community, our clients, our consultants, our corporate team? And I've been really focusing on where we're going. I think the first couple of weeks of this pandemic, I was very focused on the here and now. And now I have moved completely to how to serve, you know, our clients and community for the future. And where is this all taking us? And where can we excel moving forward? And so I've got sort of bifurcated my team to be those that are really focused on the here and now to shore up and create stability and be a trustworthy company for everyone in the short term, while we're also looking to, you know, how best serve in the long term. And it's an interesting moment in time.
You know, it's clear to me, Greg, from even this brief conversation, that you're such a visionary, that like you really were able to sort of envision this brand. And I think it's exciting to think about how forward thinking you were in terms of where beauty would head from like a clean beauty standpoint, and really how ahead of the time you were to be doing it. And, you know, thinking about that in 2011 and pre-2011, is there anything about like the little kid, Greg, that would have suggested that you would be like this entrepreneurial visionary in the future? Was there things about your childhood that pointed to the direction that you would head?
Yeah, I think for sure. I mean, I think a couple of things that were, you know, specific to my childhood that probably helped inform the decisions I made and the person I became, well, which of course is true of everyone, right? I think one, my parents were really great from the day I was born. I can remember my parents constantly telling me that I could be anything I wanted to be if I just worked really, really hard. They always said, "We believe in you. We have every confidence in you." That doesn't mean you're going to get everything you want, but if you work hard, Greg, you can do anything you want to with your life. And I think, unfortunately, that's not said enough to kids, and certainly not enough to girls. It's certainly, hopefully now more than they used to. But I think that was, they gave me the gift of confidence. I think, in addition, my parents, you know, my father, my mother got divorced, and my father made some poor choices vis-a-vis his career that took us from being a fairly well-positioned family to one with significantly lesser means. And so we became very insecure about money. And so I always was looking to be financially independent. I always had a side gig. I always was trying to, I was always working my way through, through everything. I mean, I was afforded a debt-free education, and I certainly lived, but mostly in a, still in a very, you know, privileged way in a lot of ways, but I don't think there was a lot of extra money around. And so I watched my mother, you know, do a lot of things entrepreneurially to support us. And she would buy sort of dilapidated real estate and buildings and sort of on the fringe of neighborhoods and we would fix them up and then sell them for profit and we would live off of that. And so I think I was always looking for side gigs. I was always looking to be financially secure. And I think also as I've just been an avid consumer, I love fashion, I love beauty, I love accessories. I love like the consumer world and I've always been out and touching and feeling and looking at products. I was fortunate enough to travel a lot in my life. And so I've always been able to see things that are going to trend, that are trending, but not quite yet in a forefront of consumers' minds. And I've just always liked the idea of, you know, solving problems and being a solution. And so I think it's something that I've done since literally, like I started a cleaning company when I was in college on the island of Nantucket. And I sort of have done it ever since. I do think that your childhood, I think some of it's your DNA, but I think some of it is your circumstances. And I think that for me, it was a combination of both.
I love that. And Greg, is there a CEO or a brand in particular that you admire, like somebody that you really feel like is a visionary and, you know, that you just, a journey that you really have enjoyed watching?
You know, I think that there are some brands that I respect wholeheartedly, like Patagonia. I mean, I think you can't help but, you know, love that brand for what they stand for and how they take significant positions and really walk the walk. I think that, you know, I've loved the book. I always loved the book Shoe Dog by Phil Knight. I always loved, you know, what Nike stood for, you know, back in the day, like when they started and listening to the struggles and the way that they sort of how determined they were to, you know, build this great brand. I wish they'd built, you know, I wish they'd created all the products in the United States rather than in Asia. But I believe in what they did in sort of empowering people with, you know, sort of you can just do it. And I think there are, you know, quite a few companies that play in our world today, you know, when I look at, you know, you talked about Bonobos and Brother. I mean, I think, you know, whether it's companies like that or Everlane or Allbirds or, you know, just, there's just a lot of great companies doing great work out there right now that have looked at opportunities and tried to do things differently. I think in its moment, Tom's Shoes was amazing. You know, I think there are a lot of great companies doing great things for the world. And I tend to look at those companies, Ben and Jerry's being one at the time, that you know, that really are trying to do things differently. I do believe that it shouldn't be mutually exclusive, doing well and doing good. And so I'm always looking to the leaders that are able to drive results for their investors, build profitable, successful businesses that simultaneously give back to the world. I'm really, really focused on that. And I think that there's a way. I think the future of commerce depends on us being good at doing both. And I think that the world needs us to be doing those two things simultaneously. And so those are the types of companies I look at rather than necessarily the individuals who lead them, although I'm sure there are a lot of great leaders out there that I'm just not thinking of at this particular moment on time on a Friday when I'm brain dead, which I am. So I'm like, you know, like, I, you know, so Dave, you asked me what Beauty Counter was in the beginning of this and I was like, I could barely even articulate I could barely even answer the question about what the company stands for that I started. You know, I'm like, oh, we're a brand and we're a movement. We sell beauty products. We're about clean beauty. I think it's been a really long week, but I, you know, look, that's okay. Like we all have them and certainly everyone's dealing with them in this pandemic for sure.
Oh my gosh, definitely. And actually to the contrary, I think your answers have been spectacular. I feel like I've admired you for a long time and I've learned a lot from you today, as I know the people that are listening have as well.
Well, thank you for saying that.
And I mean it. And I completely agree with you. I feel like the Friday at the end of like a quarantine week is like nothing else. Here, I feel like we start off organized on Monday, like Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday seem to go somewhat according to plan. And then Thursday and Friday, the wheels start flying off the wagon. And by the end of the day, Friday, it's like, it's a little bit crazy. So
I had a huge, like, I literally answered your phone, like in the middle of basically yelling at my daughter who has this gorgeous long blonde hair that I would, you know, kill for. My hair is like a disaster. And especially during this pandemic, I can't get it blown dry ever. And it looks so bad and frizzy and gross and whatever. And my daughter decided just to chop her hair off. So my son came running down and she's like, oh my gosh, Phoebe just cut like 6 inches off her hair. And I was like, oh my God, and that, you know, so I was like, what are you doing? So, I mean, you know, I think the one thing that I think has brought us closer as a nation or as women or as working women or as families is that, you know, whatever your circumstances are, and some are certainly much easier than others, but everyone is dealing with this pandemic and being quarantined and being with family members and trying to homeschool and trying to do all the dishes and cook the food and keep everyone safe and do the housekeeping and run their jobs. It's a lot. And I have a lot of respect for, you know, people who do this on their own more than I. I think that that coupled with not having kids in school, even if someone didn't have, you know, the time to be outside of their, you know, chose not to be outside of their home in terms of a working capacity or chose not to have anyone helping with their kids or whatever, they at least in general have people at some point in the day have a break from some aspect of it. And it's been intense. It's been intense for everyone. And I really commend everyone for, like, I think people have done a darn good job. And I think it's brought people closer. And there's like a level of humility that you see across the board that I think is really refreshing and probably much needed. So it's been a good reset, even though the circumstances have been, you know, super difficult and depressing.
Oh, I totally agree. I started this podcast off at my desk, then I was in our kitchen, and now I'm sitting on the floor of my daughter's room just because, like, there were so many other things going on at the same time that, like, I couldn't interrupt this podcast, of course, with my family unit being the least important of what's happening here at the moment. And then my daughter just came in and took my phone, which I realized was gone a couple minutes later when I went to see what time it was. So I feel like it's like a whole new ball game. I mean, the fact that I've even somehow figured out how to hopefully record these at home is like a new feat too. I usually don't have any sort of technology savvy myself. So hopefully I've got this all down. But Greg, thank you so much for joining me today. You know, admired you for a long time.
Thank you, Kim.
Love, love, love your brand. And it's an absolute pleasure having an opportunity to connect. And I look forward to continuing the conversation.
Well, listen, I so appreciate you having me. And it's always an honor to be able to speak to fellow entrepreneurs and others who have, you know, are trying to build businesses. And I always want to instill a little hope in people that they've got everything that they need to be successful and they just need to overcome their fear and go for it. And obviously you're, you know, one of the people that has done it, but you and I both know there's so many women, especially that really are challenged to find the confidence to realize their dreams and potential. And so I love talking about business and entrepreneurism in hopes that I can help one more person, you know, go for it. So thank you for having me. I hope you have a wonderful weekend. You're staying home and safe and healthy. And I look forward to talking with you, you know, face to face at some point sometime soon.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Greg. I appreciate your kind words. Thank you for joining.
I hope you enjoyed the episode. For more information and tips from our guests, stop by monicaandandy.com or check us out on Instagram at monicaandandy. If there's someone you want to hear from or a topic you'd like us to cover, please leave us a comment on iTunes. Thanks for tuning in.